Welcome to Science Studio. I am Russ Chianelli. Stress. How does it affect your brain? What happens? How can you relieve the stress? Well, today we have an expert, Dr. Cheryl Conrad from Arizona State University, who is here on Science Studio to tell us how to reduce your stress and also how it affects your brain. Welcome to Science Studio, Cheryl.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
How did you, when you were a kid, how did you get into this area?
Very serendipitously. It wasn't a topic that I thought about, but I love biology. I loved my science classes. I loved dissecting. And so when I went to college, my goal was to go to medical school. And it wasn't until my beginning of my third year, that I realized, as I was looking at the portfolio that I needed letters of recommendation. The best way to get one was to join a research lab. And at the time, my GPA wasn't the strongest. I had a lot of other interests and a lot of the requirements. At this time, there were books. You had to go into the advising office and pour through the books and look at the handouts. And so I was looking for one that wasn't focused on GPA and one that required someone to have commitment, responsibility, dedication, and it happened to be a neuroscience lab. And Norm Weinberger was the PI, and he was studying learning and memory, and he interviewed me and decided to take a chance with me and bring him in the lab. And I loved being in the forefront of science. I loved designing studies, hypothesis-driven studies, and Norm worked very closely with me to mentor me through this. And because of him, I got interested in neuroscience. And I was interested in learning and memory. I was interested in plasticity. And the rest just kind of was very serendipitous. Where I went and where I applied to school, who accepted me with my whole portfolio that I had a strong letter of recommendation. My grades improved in the latter part. And so in the end, studying stress and learning memory was a perfect marriage of these themes of brain plasticity. I'm interested in behavior, and then stress perturbs it. And I was very interested in how those came together.
I have a similar story that I could tell you about in New York about getting an invitation to go to Columbia Medical School. And I thought, nah, I don't want to do that because my friend's father was a big doctor in Park Avenue. And I said to my friends, I don't want to go and look at old people's stomachs every day like your father. But it was really a love of science. And what I'd like to ask you is, can you go back to even younger, like when you were 7 or 8? Were you dissecting bugs in the backyard? Or?
No, I don't remember doing that. I was a jack of all trades. I love sports. I was very physically active. I was engaged every opportunity I could have. I played softball, I played field hockey, I played volleyball, and I felt very healthy doing those kinds of things. And I also loved art. I took every art course that I could. So I think in the end, science kind of brought a lot of those together. Health is so important for longevity and physical well-being and being physically active helps contribute to that. I think being a scientist involves being creative, and I believe I incorporate a lot of that because you have to think outside the dogma. So as I look back, but I always gravitated to biology. I always got excited about when we would do anything related to the physiology of the organism. That's why I thought medical school was for me, and I didn't know of other alternatives at that time. I grew up in California. When I was transitioning from junior high to high school, at that time, this dates me, they passed Prop 13, and the property values in California were skyrocketing, and people who bought property there couldn't afford to pay the taxes. And so that capped it, but it had a ramification on the schools. And so summer school got canceled by the time I entered high school. A lot of these extracurricular activities got canceled. But for me, I had capitalized on it as much as I could, and that's I guess where my passion lied, was kind of bridging all of those.
I find a lot of students want to go to medical school, And there's certain things you got to do, get all A's in chemistry and so on. But I always ask them, I said, why do you want to be a doctor? Do you want to help people, or did your grandmother tell you that's what you have to do?
It's a great question.
And the thing about it is what you're telling us is that you just figure this out for yourself. And that's what I did myself, and I think that's what is very good for people to understand.
When I figured it out myself, one of the reasons why I was bringing up the Prop 13, they got rid of the counselors who counseled us. So I did have to figure it out on my own. And when I applied to undergraduate school, I didn't have the resources to help me figure out which school to apply to. And where I applied was very accidental. I got an early admission application, and my thought was they wanted me. Of course I'll apply there. So I only applied to one school, and it was University of California, Irvine. Turned out to be a very good decision, an excellent school. But that was a mindset that I had at the time. But I got a great mentor there, Norman Weinberger, and he worked with me. So when I applied to programs in neuroscience for graduate school, it was very thoughtful. So it was a very different process. But having someone to mentor you is really important. And your query about why do you want to be a doctor? Many of the students who join my research team want to go to medical school. And I want to help them pursue their dream, whatever it may be. It might not be what I want to do, but that's okay. I want them to pursue what they want to do. And they'll say the same thing. I want to help people. And so I'll ask them, I said, well, when medical schools are going to be looking at this, they will say, well, you could do this in many ways. You could be a nurse. You could be a physician practitioner. You could be a physician. And it doesn't hone in on why a physician. And they'll look at me and say, well, I don't know. I said, well, you really need to articulate that and why that particular medical school and why a physician in particular, because you could do that in so many ways. You could do volunteer work. You could be a therapist. So they just need to figure out maybe it makes sense for them to be in a different profession, and they just have to figure it out themselves.
Many years ago, I was interviewing a Nobel Prize winner, and somebody asked him, how do you pick your students? He said, I pick the students that can show me they took risks. And I think that's very interesting. By the way, are you a baseball fan?
I love baseball.
Are you following the World Series?
Well, when the Diamondbacks didn't quite make it, so I have a couple of favorite teams.
Well, the reason I'm bringing that up is you know, watching the World Series, and if you're 0 for 8 at the plate and you strike out every time, don't you think that's a good example of stress? And how do those guys handle that?
Yes, that's a great question. And the important thing is getting in the zone. And certainly,
well, tell us what you mean by getting in the zone.
So getting in the zone means you just focus about what you need to do at that moment in time. You're not thinking about what happened before. You're not thinking about what's happening in the future. When you begin to do that, you begin to perseverate. You begin to think about what you did wrong, what might happen, what ifs. And these are all – you can't change what you happened in the past. You are worrying about problems that might not manifest in the future. And so getting in the zone is just thinking what you need to do at this particular moment in time. And when I played ball, when I got up to the plate, right up until you get there, you're hearing the fans cheering. You're hearing your coach saying things. You're hearing your teammates. You're hearing the opposing team. And as soon as you get at the plate and you're looking at the pitcher, all of a sudden it becomes silent. And you're focused on what that pitcher is doing. And that's kind of the zone. You're no longer worrying about what you just did. You're no longer worrying about what you're doing in the future. You're just focused on doing what you need to do right at that moment.
I was coaching Little League. I have a son and a daughter. And the son was playing second base in a big game with lights and all that. And the ball went through his legs into the outfield. And I couldn't do anything to help him. He said, take me out. Why am I here? Blah, blah, blah. Same thing with my daughter. She's playing ball, too. The same thing. The ball goes through her legs, and what happens? All the girls laid down in the field and laughed as hard as they could for 10 minutes. So there's a question there. Is there a difference in this zoning between men and women? Or is that a difficult question?
Yeah, no, that is a difficult question. I don't know if I know how to answer it, but there's another component, and that might be the team dynamic. I think that's really important. I think certainly there are a multitude of sex differences in how we respond to stress. But in this particular case, I would say that there might be a very supportive team there, that they all have good camaraderie. And in that case, it just sounds like a good outcome.
Yeah, it was a very good outcome for the girls.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they enjoyed it very much. And I noticed that all the time. They seemed to have more fun than the boys' team. In a sense of, you know, we've got to win and we've got to beat those people and so on and so forth. And I always wondered about that psychology, you know?
Yeah, I think you could have fun and still be a strong team and could win. And so I would say that's a different kind of coaching style. I don't know if that is related necessarily to stress per se and sex differences, but I've been on teams where it was a very focused win, 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 and other times it was a very supportive team, and people would go out there, and you know they're not necessarily your strongest players, but you really want the best for them, and you feel as a team you're going to do well with the group that you have.
Let's take this to the point now where you're actually talking about the effect on the brain.
Okay.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I guess what happens is that it can be very deleterious if you're under so much stress for so long.
Let me just first state that stress is absolutely important for survival. We need to have a stress response to change.
Sounds like survival of the fittest.
Well, yes. If we didn't have a change in our physiology as we're encountering novel situations, it could be detrimental. And in my talk that I gave yesterday, I used the hare and the bobcat in that situation. If the hare was going along, it's a scenario of eating and not paying attention to the bobcat, it would be dead. So it needs to have a stress response in order to get the energy reserves it needs to evade the bobcat. And then the query that I asked everybody, and they got it, was who's having the stress response in the scenario of the bobcat chasing the hare? And they both are. So the bobcat, too, if it doesn't respond to its physiology that it's hungry,
it starves.
Exactly. So they both need to have a stress response. So that's absolutely vital. It's conserved. There's so many different organisms that have a stress response. So something seems to be working right to have that. The question is when we have a stress response, we need to then shut it down when the stressor is over so that we can go back to our other needs. We need to eat. We need to reproduce. We need to sleep. And so the key is, how do you deal with multiple stressors that are impinging on you? If you don't have a healthy balance, it could accumulate and you could have chronic stress. And today's world, there's so many different worries that are ongoing. So people are worried about Ebola. Is that a valid worry? From what I see, there are more deaths from car accidents, there are more deaths from the flu epidemic, and yet we've had only one death in the United States. It's relatively contained, and yet there's so much worry. And so people are worrying about something that might not have a problem right now. We have other government agencies and individuals that are tasked with dealing with the long-term solution, but why should each individual worry about that?
You're listening to Science Studio, where our guest is Dr. Cheryl Conrad from Arizona State University, and we'll be right back.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. The most common types of cancer treatment are surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation, but we're well aware of their limitations. So scientists are continually searching for new therapies.
One that's showing great promise is immunotherapy, a revival of an approach from a century ago. Immunotherapy activates a person's own immune system to fight cancer, and there are three main types.
The first uses antibodies, which are proteins produced by specialized immune cells. Antibodies recognize and attach to molecules on the surface of cancer cells, killing them.
Another uses cytokines, which are protein molecules that control the activities of the immune system, much like the conductor of a symphony. Cytokines activate a myriad of molecules and cells in the immune system to destroy cancer cells.
Finally, there are cell-based therapies using T cells. Scientists extract these immune cells from tumors, grow them to high numbers in the lab, enhance their cancer-killing properties, and reintroduce them into the body.
Lately, we've seen remarkable results using cancer immunotherapy on melanoma, an aggressive skin cancer. Researchers recently identified a T-cell protein, PD-1, that was inhibiting the cell's cancer-killing potential. When they blocked PD-1, patients lived well beyond expected survival times.
In another study, this time with removing T-cells from leukemia patients and re-engineering them to recognize and target cancer cells, trials have shown 45 of 75 patients went into remission.
Cancer's immunotherapy potential is so promising that in 2013 it was named Breakthrough of the Year. Let's hope it continues to surprise us.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. I'm Russ Canelli, and we were talking to Dr. Cheryl Conrad, Arizona State University. We're talking with Cheryl here about the effects of stress and how actually stress is a survival of the fittest, where when any situation you're in, you really need to be prepared to respond to it so you survive or get food or whatever it is, as we've talked about. But there are cases where there's permanent damage. Could you talk a little bit more about it?
Sure. And so I just previously described how important it is to have a stress response, but what if it's persistent? So there are changes in the brain that occur with chronic stress, and they're not all the same. And depending on what brain structure you're looking at, the response is going to be different. And one of the structures that I'm particularly interested in is the hippocampus. It's a brain structure, part of the limbic system, that is germane for emotions and memory. It regulates part of the visceral reaction that individuals
have. And it's part of the brain. It's in the back. Is that right?
No, actually.
It's in the front.
So the limbic system is underneath the cortex. So it you can't visually see it if you're to look at the brain. But it's in the temporal lobes. And the temporal lobes is named after, if you touch your temple,
it's kind of
in that region right there. And so it's kind of like a horseshoe-shaped structure. It's named after a seahorse, hippocampus. So this structure does reduce in size when individuals are chronically stressed. And what I look at is I look at individual neurons in this region as a litmus of what's happening for the whole structure. And the part of the neuron that I look at are the dendrites.
Two questions come up right now. How do you look at these?
Well, in my case, I need to remove the brain, so anybody who wants to volunteer probably wouldn't want to. And we stain it, and we stain it with a particular technique that highlights 1 to 2% of the neurons, and we can actually see the full neuron in its soma, the dendritic arbors, and we could actually look at it and quantify it. And what we find is these dendritic arbors retract in chronically stressed individuals. We also have looked at the amygdala, which is also part of the limbic structure. And the amygdala is known for emotional regulation. And people who have a dysregulated amygdala will be more likely to fly off into a rage. You've heard of road rage. This structure is critical to respond to immediate threat, but it also needs to be regulated. And the structure that regulates it is part of the prefrontal cortex.
So let me ask, it's just fascinating because if let's say somebody was killed in an accident and road rage was involved there, can you actually see the effect in the brain? Has there been studies that show that that part has been damaged?
Well, that's the misnomer. When you call it damaged, one of the things I was leading up to is that stress doesn't impact the brain similarly. In the hippocampus, we see some retraction of these specialized areas of the neurons. But in the amygdala, it's actually enhanced. It actually is more prominent. So what this means is that the amygdala might be less likely to be hindered so that when a person encounters a emotionally arousing situation, they would be more likely to react.
So that part of the brain is actually upgraded, or
correct,
however you would say it, so that your reaction would be worse or something.
Correct, yes. And let me just tell you, we're doing this collaboration with Johnny Lipschitz at Barrow Neurological Institute, and he's looking at traumatic brain injury. And I gave a talk there, and we discussed later some of his work, and he was saying that if you do a single traumatic brain injury model in an animal model, and then you could see immediately that there might be some motor dysfunction, but they recover. And this is one of the challenges in traumatic brain injury, or TBI, is that how do you determine that there has been brain damage with a single incident? We know that when it's cumulative that you do have outcomes, but could we detect it sooner? Could we detect it after the very first time
that
someone had...
Sounds like we're getting back to the NFL again.
Well, it could be related to that. And I said, you know, in the stress literature, one of the first studies that was very exciting to me was showing that chronic stress caused this amygdalar structure to become robust, more dendrites, which is in contrast to the hippocampus, which it gets smaller. And then after a couple of years, someone had the foresight to do a single stressor and wait that same length of time that one would have implemented a chronic stress paradigm, but they only got one stressor instead of cumulative stress, and looked in the brain and discovered that that same structure became enlarged. So a single incident. And I said, I bet you anything, if we look at some of your models of traumatic brain injury and we look in the amygdala, let's see if there is any changes in the dendritic arbors there. So our hypothesis was that TBI would cause an increase in dendritic arbors that would get greater with time. We looked 1 day, 7 days, and 28 days after this, and part of our hypothesis was true. We saw enhanced dendritic arbors at 28 days, but we also saw it 1 day later.
Can you describe a little bit more of the dendrites?
Sure. So the dendrites are the receiving end of information for a neuron. So the neuron has about 30,000 inputs, synaptic inputs from other parts of the brain. And so this is the source of incoming signals to the neuron.
Right. Somehow they're involved in the Alzheimer's, aren't they? They get taken out or?
Yeah. Well, with Alzheimer's, you actually have cell loss. So what I'm talking about is not cell loss per se. I'm talking about remodeling. And so the brain circuitry is being shifted from a emotionally robust, responsive system that might not form as strong memories using the hippocampus because that's compromised. Whereas in Alzheimer's system, they actually lose neurons.
Can you tell us a little bit more about what you're going to really focus on in the future?
Well, what I'm starting to do right now, and I submitted a grant proposal, hopefully they'll review it favorably, is I'm interested in how we could recover from chronic stress. And one of the interesting aspects about some of the descriptions that I've told you in the hippocampus is it's not permanent, which is great. And what that means is that if you stop the stressor and you wait in time, you could actually see some improvement in returning of those dendritic arbors in the hippocampus. And we have since discovered this is not passive, which means it just doesn't happen naturally. It requires some active mechanisms in the brain. And so we're interested in understanding those mechanisms.
There must be also treatments, drugs, and so on that can help.
One of the parallels that we have with our work is that animal models using chronic stress have a lot of parallels with depression. And in rodents, of course, you can't ask them how they're feeling. So we call it depressive-like outcomes. And when we look at antidepressants, we see that that could help and reverse some of the changes that we're looking at in the hippocampus. So that those drugs are available. But the problem is that when an individual is having symptoms of depression, we still don't have a perfect way to treat that. Often what physicians will do is prescribe a medication that they feel would work, see if it does, and watch. And if that individual is not improving, what do they have to do? They have to titrate them down from that drug medication and start them on something else. And it's awful for people that are suffering in the throes of depression. And so by understanding more of the mechanisms that are underlying some of these outcomes, we could better hone in treatments that could be more individualized. And we're just not there yet.
I was reading somewhere that they were attaching electrodes to the skull, and people were looking at pictures, and then they got these signals saying this is what is in the brain, and then they could actually recreate pictures that people were thinking about. Have you heard of that?
I have heard of that, yes.
And that to me was kind of amazing and scary in some ways.
Well, if you think about it, for us to have memories, we have to have that represented in some way in a neural network. And it could be very individualized. So for someone to image your brain and to know what your image of a hammer is, for example, doesn't necessarily mean that that's going to be my neural network for the hammer. So they could probably hone it in for you, but they're looking more at the cortical layers. From my understanding,
they can't go deeper. They could recreate these pictures. How is this, you know, electronic age that we're in affecting this is really the question. And I, from my point of view, it seems like it could be quite negative.
I think technology could always be scary and moved in a direction that could be aversive, but it could also be very positive. And I think when you go all the way back to Galileo, he was persecuted too. And I think, you know, as scientists, we have to be mindful about what we're doing, but we also have to make sure that we're reaching out to the public, we're reaching out to our legislatures. We need to just be informed, and we just have to be smart about it, but it doesn't mean that we have to not continue science.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. I always use the Galileo analogy in my classes, you know, and said, look, we're not at the center of the universe.
Yeah, right.
I always tell the students, find the science truth. You know, one of the ones that we argue about all the time is global warming, global cooling. I said, team, you take the position of global warming, you take the negative position, but at the end, you both give a talk about what the science is. And I think that's something in a lot of these cases that the students really need to learn, you know?
I think so, too. I think it's important to have both perspectives. Absolutely.
And then go for the basic truth. It's very, very nice to have you here on Science Studio. Our guest today was Dr. Cheryl Conrad from Arizona State University, and we really enjoyed the talk. Please come back, and thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Health Sciences Academy opened August 4th in Santa Teresa. It is a tuition-free public charter school focused on preparing students for health-related careers. The school accepts students starting at 7th grade. All class curriculum integrates health and science and emphasizes project-based learning. Students will intern and volunteer with hospitals and clinics. Read more at mcasynapse.org.